Hey, Summit family, welcome to the Summit Church Podcast. I'm Pastor J.D. Greer.
And I'm Pastor Brian Laritz. We are very thankful you have come to listen to the message from this week.
You know, our mission here at the Summit Church is to follow the Holy Spirit in creating a movement of disciple-making disciples here in Raleigh-Durham and around the world.
And we are encouraged by you coming to listen and to know God through His Word. We do have many resources here at the Summit Church to help you grow as a disciple in worship, witnessing, stewardship, servanthood, and as a church and community member.
Yeah, you know, and the best place to check all that out is at our website, summitchurch.com, or even better would be our Summit Church app. It's got a lot of great tools on it, ways that you can get connected, way it can be more than just a listening experience, but really kind of just a part of your discipleship process.
Yes, there are several ways to plug in, and we hope you will join us on mission.
Ultimately, we're excited and very thankful that you are listening, and we hope this teaching is going to deepen your relationship with God and encourage your mission to be sent, both to your community and those around you. All right, James chapter 3, if you have your Bibles, James chapter 3. As you were turning there, I have a story that some of you are going to hate and some of you are going to love. A few years ago, the car that I was driving at the time was a 2003 Honda Pilot, started to smell weird. It was an older car, and I thought maybe I'd left one of the windows cracked or maybe one of the seams, you know, little rubber things had broken. And when it was raining, maybe the carpet got wet and it had mildewed or something like that. So I pulled it into the garage and I turned a fan on the inside to dry it out, but that didn't work. Smell didn't go away. So I took out all the mats and shampooed them and scrubbed the floorboards, but that didn't work either. Still smelled. Eventually, I figured out that the smell seemed to be coming through the vents of the car. So I bought one of those little deodorizers shaped like a pine tree and hung it right on one of the vents. But that didn't work either. If anything, the smell was getting worse. So I bought one of those little pine tree thingies for each of the vents, thinking that might take care of it. The inside of my car looked and smelled like a Christmas tree, except a Christmas tree hiding a dead body or something like that. So I figured that I should clean the whole ventilation system. But I'm not a mechanic, and I have no idea how to take apart and put back together an air conditioner for a car. So I found the little air intake valve that's down near the floorboard on the passenger side of the car. You know what I'm talking about? I found that little air intake thing, and I took a full bottle of Lysol disinfectant spray. I turned the AC on full blast and sprayed the entire bottle into the air intake so that the disinfectant would cycle through the whole system. Y'all, I thought that was particularly ingenious, by the way, and I am still proud of it, but still smelled after I was done with that. By this point, the smell had become almost unbearable, like middle school cabin at student camp on the fourth night of camp, unbearable, that kind of smell. So begrudgingly, I took my Honda Pilot to my mechanic. I dropped it off. I braced for the $400 bill, which is what I feel like it costs just to drive the car onto the lot of a mechanic. He called me less than an hour later, and he said, "It's all ready for you, son." And I said, "Well, that was fast. What was wrong with it?" He said, "Well, I'll explain it when you get down here." So I pulled up to his shop. When I pulled up, he had the weirdest looking grin on his face, and he said nothing. He just held up this poor, dead, mangled rat by the tail. He said, "There's your smell, son." And suddenly I remembered this incident a couple of weeks before when I'd started the car up and I heard this grinding sound, but then it stopped. So I figured whatever was wrong in there just kind of worked itself out. You know how these things are. My mechanic was laughing so hard, he wouldn't even let me pay him for it. No, fixing this was my pleasure, son. You've done me a favor. By the way, true story, that mechanic got saved and baptized at our church a few years later, okay? And I like to think that that poor rat played a little part of his conversion story. That his little rat life and Freon lace death had some meaning after all. So why do I share with you this terrible story? It's because today I want to talk about something small in the, shall we say, the ventilation system of your life, so to speak, that has the capacity to make your whole life stink, no matter how many little proverbial air fresheners you hang on your vents. For some of you, it stinks right now. This morning, it's already stunk. And you're the last person to even know about it.
James chapter 3, verse 2 is where we will begin to read. James says, we all stumble in many ways. And if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able also to bridle his whole body. If we put bits into the mouths of horses so that they obey us, we guide their whole bodies as well. That's what the tongue is like, he says. It's something that guides the whole body, or verse 4. Look at the ships also. Here's a second analogy, by the way. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great things. Verse 5, here's his third analogy. By the way, they always say that for public speakers, you should never use more than one analogy or more than one illustration to make your point. James clearly has not heard that, so here is his third analogy. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. In the same way, the tongue is a fire. It is a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the course of life, the entire course of life. And that is set on fire by hell itself. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. There's your fourth analogy. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it, we bless our Lord and Father. And with that same tongue, on the same day, sometimes in the same conversation, we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening, both fresh water and salt water? There's your fifth analogy. Can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives? Or a grapevine, can it produce figs? There is your sixth analogy. Neither then can a salt pond yield fresh water. Now, class, what thing are we talking about? What small thing are we talking about that causes all these problems and prompts all these analogies? What is it? That's right, the tongue. And it's why I've titled this message, It's Hard to Lick Your Tongue, okay? And yes, I came up with that myself, and I'm pretty proud of it. All jokes aside, I was really very, very convicted. As I was writing this message this week, I struggle with this so much, I would give myself a failing grade at this. So please, bear with me today. I'm just gonna try to be the messenger that is preaching to you and also to me. In this passage, James makes three points about our tongues, our words. And then James points us toward a solution. So here we go. Point number one, James says the tongue has incredible power. He compares it, verse 3, to a bit like you might use to control a horse. In verse 4, to a rudder that steers a ship, both very small relatively in themselves, but both with incredible ability to control the large, powerful bodies they're attached to. I love reading about World War II history, particularly naval warfare. It's probably because my grandfather, I've told you, served on an aircraft carrier in the South Pacific in World War II. One of my favorite sea battle stories is the story about the sinking of the German battleship, the Bismarck, by the British Navy in 1941. The Bismarck was the largest, most well-fortified battleship Germany or any nation had ever produced. It was so fast, so strongly built that it was considered unsinkable, the unsinkable Bismarck. It could outrun any other ship on the water. It was so steel reinforced that it could withstand a considerable amount of torpedoes and bombs. Well, British aerial recon unexpectedly sighted the Bismarck on May 21st, 1941 in the North Atlantic. A couple of British planes fired some torpedoes at it, and they assumed that they had missed because they saw no explosion, which meant that the Bismarck would get away because it was so much faster than all the British ships. But to everyone's surprise, as the Bismarck was sailing away, it suddenly turned back toward the British Navy. Then it started to zigzag and then started just to go in circles. That torpedo, they later figured out, had jammed the rudder, and this incredible ship could not go straight any longer. It could only go in circles. At that point, the British Navy just pummeled it like a sitting duck with bombs and torpedoes. The mighty, unsinkable Bismarck sent to the bottom of the Atlantic because of a jammed rudder. Your tongue is like that, James says. It's a relatively small part of your body, but it determines the entire course of your life. People form their opinions of you based on your words. They determine your intelligence by your words. They decide if they want to be friends with you based on your words. You begin and end relationships with your words. With your tongue, you draw people close. With your tongue, you push them away. I mean, just think for a minute about how words, specific words, have changed your life. I love you. I'm proud of you. We want you. You're not very good. We're gonna have to go a different direction. I wanna break up. Your best relationships came about through words. Your most estranged relationships became that way through words. In verse 5, James compares the tongue to a fire. Massive, destructive fires in our world are started by the smallest of sparks. This terrible conflagration going on right now in Maui started at 6:30 a.m. on August 8th with one severed power line. Just one. A single spark on some dry grass. You can go back and watch videos of it on YouTube. After the first few minutes, it was no bigger than 10 square feet, like 3x3. So small you could step right over it without getting hurt. 3 hours later, authorities said that the small brush fire was 100% contained. No problem. And yet, later that same afternoon, we were all watching horrifying videos of people abandoning their cars and swimming out into the Pacific Ocean to avoid the growing inferno. At this point, it is the worst natural disaster in the state's history. And we're only beginning to know the extent of it. Lives lost, hundreds injured, thousands of homes destroyed. All of that from one spark. The tongue is like that, James says. Think about the destruction that has come into the world through words. It's been said, for example, that 125 people died for each word of Adolf Hitler's manifesto, Mein Kampf. We know about the horror of the Holocaust, but we don't often think about how it all began with words, not with weapons. The death-to-word ratio in Mao's Little Red Book would be even higher. Think about the destruction that has come into your life personally through words. If I asked most of you to recount the most painful moment of your life, chances are it would involve something that was said to you or about you. For many of you struggling with the effects of trauma, your trauma goes back in part to things said to you or about you. Or those of you with low self-esteem, it was what your parents or your friends said about you. Or think about the pain that your words have caused others. Our counseling director, Dr. Brad Hambrick, says, he says, complete this sentence. If only I hadn't blank. Says, for most of us, the next word in that sentence would be the word said. Right? For most of us. If your marriage is falling apart, chances are it was due in large part to words. What was said, what was not said, how it was said. Dr. Hambrick says, there is almost no such thing where the couple speaks, no such thing as a bad marriage where the couple speaks well to each other. Some of you have lost jobs because of careless words or injudicious emails. I knew a guy one time who was so incredibly talented. I mean, so gifted, got results. Almost always had a good attitude when you saw him. Pleasant, easy to get along with, but man, he would get behind that keyboard and he would turn into Terminator 2. Leaving nothing but scorched earth behind. Incredibly talented guy whose career came crashing down because of his inability to control his words. Or maybe you know the infamous story of Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. You may know the story of their epic boxing battle and the bitter feud that surrounded it, but what you may not know about them is that previously, before this, they had been the best of friends. What ended the friendship was when Muhammad Ali, in an effort to promote his first fight against Frazier, Joe Frazier, started calling Joe Frazier an Uncle Tom and an ugly gorilla. The war of words got so bitter that not only did it end the friendship, it left deep reservoirs of hatred and bitterness, particularly in Frazier's soul. Biographers say that Frazier went to his grave a bitter man, bragging that he was the one who gave Muhammad Ali his Parkinson's disease, even rejoicing over Ali's sickness. That hatred was provoked not by fists, it was provoked by words. Maybe you got some relationship in your life like that, like a bit, like a rudder, like a fire. The tongue contains the power of life and death. James, the second point. The tongue is nearly impossible to tame. The tongue's nearly impossible to tame. Verse 7, James says, every kind of beast, birds, reptiles, a crab, a sea creature, a snake, a fish, they can all be tamed. And they have been tamed by mankind. There ain't no human being alive that can tame the tongue. Y'all, I love this analogy. You can tame just about any animal. People got all kinds of strange pets. Recently, my family and I were at a small horse farm, and the owner of this horse farm said, you got to see my pig. And she mentioned this pig like four times, to the point that it became apparent that she was really, really proud of this pig, and it was going to cause relational damage with her if we did not go see this pig. So I rounded up the kids, we went and we looked, and he was out there, you know, rooting around doing pig stuff. I even took this picture to see what I was talking about. And we walk over to the fence, and it comes over and it lifts up that ugly snout face of his, see if we had any food, of course. After he saw we didn't have any food, he wasn't that interested in us. I told my wife so that the owner could not hear me. I'm like, that might be the ugliest animal I have ever seen. And it just looks so dumb. But that lady was so proud of her pig that I went home and I did a little research. Sure enough, the internet agrees that pigs actually make great pets. According to this one article I read, pigs are the fourth most intelligent animal on the earth. I know, I did not believe it either. So I kept digging, kept rooting around like a pig would do, right? I was learning from the pig. Sure enough, pigs consistently rank in the top four or five most intelligent animals on earth. Higher than dogs on every list I saw. By the way, cats don't even make the top 10. And that's because cats are nothing but evil personifieds, okay? So learn your lesson. This article said that we don't usually realize the pig's intelligence because they have an unrelenting quest for food, and so they're always rooting around. It seems like they're single-focused. And they got this complex about being top pig that can cause undue aggression even against the owner of the house. This article explained that once that pig picks a spot to do his business, you might as well concede that part of your territory, your yard, your house, that's theirs, because you ain't ever getting that piece of property back. But the most interesting line of this whole article was this one, and I quote, with consistent discipline and the use of some mild electric shock equipment, pigs can be trained to be darling pets. Yo, I'm not even sure what to do with that, to be honest with you. The point is, sure enough, every kind of beast can be tamed. But no human being, even with all of our positive thinking and our self-help techniques, none of us can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil, James says. It's a world of unrighteousness, verse 6. It's empowered by the flames of hell itself, that thing in your mouth. It would be easier to tame a spitting cobra than it would be that tongue of yours. It is full of deadly poison, verse 8, and it strikes at the most inopportune times. Think about how often you've said something that now you so wish you could just take back. Again, remember Brad's observation. Complete the sentence. If only I hadn't blanked. For most of you, the next word in that sentence will be the word said. These forest fires that James is talking about in verse 5, they're not usually caused by arson. They're usually caused by carelessness, right? Just like in Maui, nobody intentionally started the blaze. It was a careless spark. A lot of the fires in your life are because something slipped out. Right? A hateful comment, an outburst of anger, a degrading comment, or the verbalization of an inappropriate lust. Wasn't arson, it was just carelessness. Because nobody can tame the tongue, and that's because number three, James says, the tongue reveals the depravity of our heart. The tongue reveals the depravity of our heart. Verse 12, your words are the single best indicator of the state of your heart. If you remember back when we were studying through James 1, I told you to imagine if you had a little, remember I said, imagine if you had a little monitor on the side of your head that displayed for everybody exactly, unfiltered, whatever you were thinking at any moment. How horrid that would be. Well, see, our words are the closest thing to having that monitor. Your words are the clearest and best indicator of what's actually in your heart, which is why Jesus said, every idle word will be brought into evidence at the judgment. And that's because he says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. It means that's what is down in there is inevitably gonna come out. I explained to you when we're going through James 1 that when you say something you regret, when you give an angry word, something harsh or condemning or judgmental, a degrading comment, the verbalization of a lust, later you're embarrassed by it. And so you want to go back and apologize. You want to make amends. And I asked you, I was like, how do you do that? You always go back to the person you said it to and you say something like, what? I didn't really mean that. That's not really me. But I pointed out the irony of that is that in that moment, the moment that you said it, you sure did mean it. You'd never meant anything more in your life. And if that wasn't really you, well, then who was it from? No, the truth is that you're frustrated at yourself for not better filtering it. But just because you successfully filter it doesn't mean it's not still in your heart. We're frustrated with ourselves for not putting better filters on our mouths when what we should do is lament what our words reveal about the depravity of our hearts. We keep trying to fix ourselves through our fresheners. Air freshener is gonna help us, but there's a dead rat in the deep recesses of your heart. And that dead rat is your sinful nature, and it is smelling up your entire life, which is why so many of our words stink. In verse 6, James says that the tongue is set on fire by the flames of hell itself. That is not just a hyperbolic metaphor. It means that the powers of sin and corruption and hell itself, our depravity, they're at work in our heart, and it manifests from our tongues. Hear this. A tongue problem is ultimately a heart problem. And that's what James hints at in verse 12. Or so, can a fig tree, my brothers, bear olives? No matter how much a fig tree wants to produce olives, no matter how many books it reads on olive production, no matter how many seminars it goes to on olive production, no matter how much willpower it exerts, no matter how much it hangs around with olive trees, if fig tree ever producing olives, neither can a salt pond, he says, yield fresh water. Your problem, James says, is that your heart is a saltwater pond of undrinkable water, and no amount of filtering or deodorizing is gonna change that. You got a dead rat in your central ventilation system, and no amount of those little pine tree thingies or scrubbing your floorboards is gonna change that. The heart is deceitful above all things, the prophet Jeremiah said, and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Jeremiah goes on, chapter 30, to say that the wound of that heart is incurable. Or like Jesus himself said in Matthew 15, 19, out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander, all kinds of depravity come out of that heart. Our culture says, oh, follow your heart. I'm telling you, that is the last thing that you want to follow. Your heart is a mess, and the worst things that slip out of your mouth are just a fraction of the actual depravity that's down there. In fact, think of it like this. Your words are like the tip of an iceberg. All those sinful, unkind words reveal, you only see a fraction. They say about 1/5 of the average iceberg is what you see. The other 4/5 are under the water. You got this massive depravity of spirit underneath. Words indicate your heart, which is why, again, listen, every idle word, Jesus said, every idle word is gonna be brought into judgment. Yo, isn't that terrifying? Every idle word means things you said in private. Things you said to yourself, things you said to your spouse. Slanderous, unkind, uncharitable, mean-spirited, gossiping, hypocritical words, even those said to your closest friend or your spouse or even your diary. Just because you're talking to a close friend or a spouse or a relative doesn't mean you're in some kind of safe zone. Why? Because no matter who you say them to, words are just indicating your heart. Out of the abundance of the heart, your mouth speaks. Even if you keep the best air filters and you never say a wrong word, what's foul in the heart is still there. Now, I know this makes some of you ask, you go, well, wait a minute, Pastor, are you saying that at the final judgment, I'm gonna be judged and held accountable for my words? I thought Jesus had paid for and removed all of my sin. Yes, that is true. What Jesus says here about every word being brought into judgment does not cancel out everything else the Bible teaches about salvation. If you really have received Christ's forgiveness, there is no condemnation remaining for you. What Jesus means when he says to you, every idle word will be brought into judgment, as a believer, what he means is this. First, even if your sins are ultimately forgiven, you will still have to answer for them. The Apostle Paul says that at the final judgment, the works of Christians are gonna be brought forward to test whether they were good or bad, whether they reap rebuke or reward for eternity. For many of us, so many of our words are gonna be revealed as shameful and worthless. Second, and this is probably James and Jesus's more important point. Listen to this. This has been a common theme for James. For some of us, our words on judgment day are going to reveal that we were not actually Christians. Oh, we learned to act like Christians on the outside. We learned to do all the Christian things. We got super involved in church. We read our Bibles, acted morally, maybe even served on the praise team. We memorized verses. But what we said with our mouths in private indicated that our hearts had never really changed and were filled with all that old poison. So ask yourself, the way you speak about others, does it exude grace and mercy and love? Do your words sound like somebody whose heart has been sweetened by the gospel? If not, James says, maybe your religion is a sham. And you should at least consider that. You say, well, Pastor, I'm in trouble. My words indicate my heart is a mess. How can I heal my heart? How can I change the saltwater pond to a fresh mountain spring? How can I get the dead rat out? Great question. In fact, that might be the most important question in the New Testament, the Bible. How do we change the depravity of our hearts? I'm going to answer that with two biblical pictures. The metaphors that James uses for the tongue point back, I believe, to these two stories in the Old Testament. Let me give them to you. I'm going to share with you a Cliff Notes version of them, and then I'm going to close our time together with what I hope are some really, really practical applications of this, okay? Here we go. Picture number one, Exodus 15. Moses and the children of Israel are wandering through the desert. They've just left Egypt. They're on their way to the promised land, but they're thirsty. Their water supply has all but dried up, and so they come upon an oasis in the desert. At last, there is water. So they plunge into the water, and they splash around, and they begin to fill up their canteens and begin to drink. But immediately, Exodus 15 says, they begin to spit it out and vomit because the water was bitter. And so in despair, they cry out, God, all this water, we can't drink it. What are we going to do? So God tells Moses to have them cut down a tree and take that tree and throw it in. And when they do that, it says, and the bitter waters became sweet. This was right after the deliverance to the Red Sea, and it is a picture of the cross. The whole Exodus story, as you may know, is like a physical demonstration of the Christian life. It is showing that God puts the cross into the bitter waters of our heart, and the bitter waters of our heart become sweet. Why? Because at the cross, we hear words of forgiveness when what we deserve to hear were words of condemnation. The cross is about a God who speaks with love, unconditional love that we did not deserve, unconditional love that never changes and never fades away. And that love, when you really embrace it, it changes you. God's words of acceptance transform you from an insecure, suspicious, bitter person to a secure, happy, satisfied, compassionate one. And when your heart changes, your words change. When the fountain of our souls is made sweet, the water coming up from the tap starts to be sweet also. That's picture number one. Picture number two, Isaiah 6. Here you got God calling Isaiah to ministry. And so he reveals, if you've been in church, you know this scene. He reveals himself to Isaiah in the splendor of holiness. And I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and the angels around him were saying what? Holy, holy, holy. And what was Isaiah's reaction? Do you remember? Woe is me, for I am lost, and I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Isn't it amazing that when Isaiah stands in the presence of God, the first thing he realizes is dirty? The first thing he is really self-conscious about? The first thing is his lips. Think of God's holiness like one of those black lights that exposes all the germs or filth on something. You ever seen one of those? When we stand in God's holiness, the first and dirtiest places we see our sin is going to be around our mouths. Every idle word is going to be brought into judgment because that was the fountain of our depravity. So how was Isaiah healed? It says an angel takes a burning coal from the altar, so hot the angel himself can't even touch it, and he goes over and he touches Isaiah's mouth with the coal. You'd think that a burning coal that not even an angel could touch would have severely injured his mouth, but instead it heals him. The altar, the coal from the altar, of course, represents the salvation that comes from Jesus' sacrifice for our sin. We killed Jesus and that should have destroyed us, but instead when it touches us, it heals us. When we hear the declaration from the cross, behold, your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for, we are healed. Not just forgiven, we're changed. Putting the cross into the bitter waters of our hearts, placing it on our lips, heals us, which is why Paul says when we come together, we should speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual gospel songs, because in doing so, we are reminding each other every week of the good news of the gospel, which heals our hearts and cleanses our lips. Friend, if you got a history, like most of us do, of hurting others with your words, ponder anew what the Almighty can do, who with his love doth befriend thee, until that makes you a better friend to others. Renew your heart and mind in the gospel until it transforms your heart and your words become, like Jesus's words, healing and life-giving, not because you choose to make them that way, but because that's just what flows out of you. And if you've been hurt by words, which I know a number of you have, if you got these deep, painful wounds that go back to what somebody said about you or about you, I want you to dwell on the louder word of the gospel spoken to you by Jesus in the gospel. Well, may the accuser roar of sins that I have done. I know them all and thousands more. Jehovah, Jesus, knoweth none. Jesus has said to you, you are my beloved child in whom I am well pleased. Though your sins were as scarlet, I've made them white as snow. Others have told you that you're not good enough, pretty enough, smart enough. But he has said, before you were knit together in your mother's womb, I knew you, I loved you, and I laid out the plan that I had for you. Others have told you that you've messed it all up. He says to you, if any man is in Christ, he's a new creation, and I delight to deliver those who trust in me. Others have left me. He says, I will never leave you or forsake me. I will never leave you or forsake you. You've heard acceptance and healing and love from the most significant lips in the universe. That can heal your soul. Now, before we close, let me apply all this with a few really, what I hope are practical bits of counsel. A, be slow to speak, right? This should be self-obvious. This is counsel straight from James himself, James 1:19. Be slow to speak. Think about it. Knowing the power of the tongue and how closely connected our tongues are with the depravity of our hearts, we should be slow to speak. And we should be very careful when we do. The book of Proverbs says it like this. In many words, sin is not lacking. Which means if you have a disposition to talk a lot, you sin a lot. David Jeremiah says, people with a propensity to talk a lot, I mean, they can't go on forever talking about nothing. They inevitably go on to scandal and gossip rather than just be silent. You got to learn when to be silent. I love how Martin Luther said it. I have learned this art. When I have nothing more to say, I stop speaking. Y'all, that would be great counsel for some of you. Some of you, when you have nothing more to say, you head to Twitter. Bad idea, okay? In fact, I wish Luther himself had heeded that counsel toward the end of his own life. But it's great counsel. Ask yourself before saying something about somebody, do I really need to share this about that person? Is there anything profitable that will come from me repeating this tale, or am I simply delighting in sharing the faults or the misfortunes of others? Think about it, because Jesus said you're gonna be brought into judgment for that idle gossip spoken to your friend or your spouse or your daughter. I said this a couple weeks ago, and I'll say it again. You can gossip with your spouse or with your children. Don't think that's some kind of neutral zone where the laws of sin don't apply. I'm glad you and your child are communicating, but don't cultivate the sin of speaking harmful, unnecessary words of criticism about others. Don't cultivate that into them. And be careful before you speak a word of criticism to your spouse or your child or your friend. Because after the frustration and your anger subsides, the wound of your words will remain. Be slow to speak. Your child will likely remember for decades that harsh word that you spoke to them in a moment of frustration and anger. Now, before you vent your anger, just be slow. Before you vent your anger at somebody in an email, ask, wouldn't it be better to let myself cool down before sending this email? Y'all, my favorite feature of Google Mail is that little unsend button. I got 7 seconds to press it. Y'all, that has saved me so many relationships. In fact, before they put that in there, one of my our staff pastors, we were dealing with a guy. And the guy, honestly, he was kind of a jerk, this other guy. And it was really kind of, it wasn't a good situation. So one of our pastors was sort of negotiating with him. This guy sends back, it was pretty ridiculous what he sent. So this pastor who, I won't tell you his name, but he forwards the email to me. And this guy had written this in this like really like royal blue, it's a really odd font. And the guy, our pastor says to me in this email, look, he's changed his font to royal blue to distract us from all the CRAP that he is shoveling in our direction, right? I look at it and then I look and this guy is copied on that email. Key had hit reply all. So I jump up and I run into the office and I go in and this guy is laying face down on the ground. And I almost called his name. I said, he said, I know. I couldn't get it back. You think about it, just like, just slow down. Abraham Lincoln famously had a drawer full of letters that he regarded as the greatest letters he had ever written, but never sent. When somebody would make him mad, he would promptly sit down and write a letter giving them what for. But then he said, I'd put it in a drawer and I'd wait until my anger cooled, usually between 1 and 3 days, and then I'd reread it and inevitably I'd change it or just not send it at all. He said, thank God I never sent most of those letters because my presidency would have been so much different if I had. Be slow to speak, because once you say a word of anger or criticism, you cannot get it back. The story is told of a guy who lived in a village who had a proclivity to gossip, and soon nobody wanted to be friends with him. He sensed how he had lost favor with all the other villagers, and so he went to the village elder to learn how he could make restitution and start over. And he says, what do I need to do? And the village elder said, he said, well, easy. I want you to take a bag full of chicken feathers and I want you to put one chicken feather in the yard of every person that you've spoken unkindly about. And that'll represent your regret for those careless words. Then I want you to come back tomorrow and I'll tell you what to do next. So the man thought, well, this is super easy. So he did it, came back the next day to the elder saying, I've done my penance. And then the elder said, not quite. Now I need you to go back to all those yards and collect all those feathers and then your reputation will be restored. And the man, of course, said, well, that's impossible. The wind has blown all those feathers away now. And the elder said, that's the dilemma with your words. Once they leave your mouth, you cannot ever get them back. So be slow to speak. Now, having said that, I want to give you B, second piece of counsel. Be slow to speak, but be quick to say, I'm sorry. Y'all, don't underestimate the power of those two words to heal. You said something to a spouse, a friend, a child, maybe a parent, maybe it was years ago. Just saying, I regret that. I'm sorry. We'll do more than you can possibly realize. I remember hearing the story through our men's ministry of a guy named Ken, who when he was a teenager was discussing his future life plans with his dad, and there was some conflict, you know, sometimes between teen and a dad, there was conflict. His dad wanted him to take some academic course and Ken didn't want to do it. And so in a moment of anger, Ken said, what do you know, Dad? You're just a dumb factory worker. His dad had never been to college. He'd always been a great dad, always provided for his family, but he was blue collar. Those words just crushed his dad's spirit. Well, Ken went off to college and they never talked about it. You know, they say time heals all wounds, which is not really true, but usually papers over the wounds. 20 years later, the relationship is okay. They talk, but after hearing a message, Ken remembered this whole incident. So he called his dad up and he said, Dad, you remember 20 years ago when I said you were just a dumb factory worker? Ken said, to my shock, my dad immediately began to cry. And Ken said, I'm so sorry, Dad. I'm so grateful for you and I'm so proud of you. All the things that really matter in life, you excelled at all of them. Some of you just need to apologize to someone, even if it's been 20 years, 10 years, 5 years. Wives, do you ever apologize to your husbands? Question, fair question. Given how much James says we sin with our lips, shouldn't apologies in a marriage be frequent? I mean, if you cannot remember the last time you apologized to your spouse, and I'll go ahead and call a spade right now, a lot of you can't. then I'm going to say that you're just not in touch with the sin that's actually in your heart. If what James is saying is true, that our tongues are untamable and are connected to our depravity, wouldn't you expect a person who grasps that, wouldn't you expect them to find themselves apologizing a lot? Husbands, do you apologize to your wives? Parents, do you apologize to your kids? Bosses, to your employees? Employees, to your bosses? Some of you college students who just arrived at college, maybe the last conversation you had before coming back to college was one of anger. Don't underestimate the healing power of simply saying, I'm sorry. Or maybe to one of your siblings. One pro tip here before I move on to these last two quick ones. Just one pro tip from Uncle JD, please. Don't go apologize to somebody and in the process inform them of something really bad you said about them that they didn't know about. I mean, you laugh, but I say that because about once a year, typically right after I preach on confession and forgiveness, somebody will come to me and tell me about really mean things that they've said about me that I never knew about. And they'll say, Pastor, I just want to apologize to you. I've said this about you and that about you around our dinner table, or we've been really critical of you in our small group. I'm sorry, all those things I said about your preaching. And I always think I was kind of better off not even knowing that you said it. So I'll just say, just speaking for me right now, if you said mean things about me and I don't know about them, I forgive you right now, categorical forgiveness. I don't even know what you said. I bestow upon thee blanket forgiveness right now, okay? If the person doesn't know you said the mean thing about them, just repent to God and anybody else you said it to and leave it there, okay? But again, the point, given how much James and Jesus say we sin with our words, we'd expect that somebody with even the slightest awareness of the depravity of their heart would apologize often. Here's your third piece of counsel that I want to give you. Third piece of counsel. So life-giving words. So life-giving words. Let me read the last few verses of this chapter really quick. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above. It is earthly and spiritual, even demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. All right, there is so much good stuff in there, and I wish we had time to plunge into it. All right, but I'm gonna have to limit myself just to two quick things. First, he is telling us to intentionally replace destructive words with life-giving ones. See how James says, verse 18, We are slow to speak, but we are quick to sow good words of peace. We should see our words as seeds that can create goodness and life in others. Let me make this real practical. I got a challenge for you this week. One challenge. I want you to choose one person in your life, just one. And every day this week, until we meet again next week, I want you to speak intentional blessing and encouragement and love into their lives. Call out a strength. Parents, bless your children every day. Let that fountain be life-giving. That's my challenge. One person, same person, every day this week. Every day, a text, a phone call, a quick convo, an email, a handwritten note, whatever it takes, watch the difference that it's going to make in their lives. Then maybe you'll find yourself doing this with others. Lastly, here's the last piece of counsel. Receive peace. You see, in order to be able to speak peace, you gotta be at peace. The reason some of you sin with your lips is because your hearts are at war. What's in your hearts is not peace, but turmoil, insecurity, and fear, and anxiety. And maybe that's because of unkind words that you've heard throughout your life. Other people have damaged you with their words. And that's why you now damage others with your words. I mean, sadly, hurt people hurt people. The way to fix that is to replace the hurtful words you've heard from others with the healing words of Jesus. You got to replace the words of criticism and comparison and judgment and condemnation and abuse and fear and anxiety with his assurance of unconditional love and empowerment. Jesus says, right now, you're safe with me. I've never stopped loving you. When you were at your worst, I loved you. Before you were even born, I had a plan for you. You are special, and I've always been there, every second by your side, weaving all of it together. Even when you couldn't see it, I was weaving it for good for you. I got you. If you're a believer, that's what he says to you in Psalm 139 and Romans 8 and a bunch of other places. Embrace those words. Dwell on them. Take them into your heart and your heart will be at peace. And then your words will become a harvest of righteousness. You'll begin to see righteousness springing up everywhere around you. And that's where we'll end. Some of you got a problem with your words. That's because of a problem in your heart. So I'm going to end this by just opening up this altar right here. I'm going to do it for two reasons. Maybe you got a problem in your heart that you need God to change. It's manifested in your words. You got a lot of things you regret. You need to come down here and say, God, heal my heart. Heal my heart because my kids, they need a daddy with a different heart. Maybe you need to speak some words of peace to somebody or say you're sorry. And you need to ask God for strength in doing that. Come and ask God for that. You say, well, why can't I pray right there in my seat? Yes, of course you can. But coming down here is your public cry for God's help. And it's your commitment to have that conversation. See, if you stay there later, you might just forget about it and renege on it. Coming down here says, I'm going to have this conversation. I'm asking you, God, right now to help me with it. Here's a second reason you might come. Maybe you need deliverance from thoughts planted in you by unkind words said to you. Listen, I'm not saying that your dad or your mom or your friend was demon-possessed when they said that thing to you. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying that Satan used that thing and you need deliverance from those words. For years, he's used them to cut up your soul. You know who you are. You're filled with anxiety and suspicion and insecurity. I want you to come down here and I want you to pray for deliverance because the blood of Jesus is powerful enough to deliver you and heal you from the slander and abuse and on the gossip that you have been inflicted on all your life. The gospel speaks a louder word than your hateful accuser speaks. Come get deliverance. For any of those reasons, I want you to come, okay? We're going to have three or four people down front at each campus. In fact, they're getting into place right now. Why don't you stand to your feet at all of our campuses? Our worship teams are going to come. If you want somebody to pray over you, grab one of these three or four. If not, you can just kneel right here beside this altar and either ask God for help or deliverance. Do you come right now? Let's just turn this into a temple of prayer as our worship teams come at all of our campuses.
Thanks so much for listening to this message. We hope you enjoyed it and it helps you fix your eyes on Jesus Christ. We would love for you to share this message with the people you know, and also remember to subscribe as well. Have questions about the Summit Church or want to find more resources? Download the Summit Church app to easily connect and check out more. Finally, if this message has impacted your life, we would love to hear from you. Let us know through the Summit app or our website, summitchurch.com. We hope you have a great week.